some in others. The other important difference is the difference of religion between the hunting culture and the agrarian culture. The religious man of the hunting culture is generally known as a shaman, S-A-H-A-M-A-N. And a shaman is a kind of weird individual, and I mean weird in the ancient sense of the word, not queer, but weird in the sense of magic, because he is a person of a peculiar type of sensitivity who finds initiation into the shaman role by going off by himself for a long time into the depths of the forests or the heights of the mountains. And in that isolation, he comes in touch with a domain of consciousness which is known by all sorts of names: the spirit world, the ancestors, the gods, or whatever. And his knowledge of that world is supposed to give him a peculiar powers of healing, of prophecy, of magic in general. The thing that you must note, though, about a shaman is that his initiation is found by himself. He does not receive initiation from an order or a guru. On the other hand, the religious man of the agrarian community is a priest. And a priest is almost invariably an ordained person. He receives his power from a community of priests or from a guru. In other words, from tradition. Tradition is all important in the agrarian community. Now then, reasonably enough, the first communities are stockaded enclosures. They are made of palings. And so we speak of people being within the pale and beyond the pale. And we, of course, the word paling we still use in fencing, and you know that the Spanish for a tree is palo. So here is a primitive stockaded community. And as often as not, this community will settle at a crossroads, for obvious reasons. Where roads cross, that's where people meet. And so it's liable to have four gates and these crossing main streets. And that immediately establishes four divisions of the city. And so, oddly enough, in Hindu society, there are four castes based on the four fundamental divisions of labor. And number one is the caste of priests, and they're called Brahmana. Number two is the caste of warriors, and also rulers, and they're called Kshatriya. Number three is the caste of merchants and tradesmen, and they're called Vaishya. And number four are laborers, and they are called Shudra. So those are the four principal roles in the world of settled humanity. It's interesting, I said people settled in cities because they had to plant. And there are many legends to the effect that what they were mostly concerned with planting were grapes for wine, and they cultivated vineyards. And it's said of Noah that after the flood in the Bible, the first thing he did was to plant a vineyard. He knew which side was up. So now, then those are the roles. Those are, you might say, masks, as it were, of the Brahman in this game called the social game. Now then, when you enter society, you are born into a caste. And this is very understandable in a community where you don't have a generalized system of education. You don't go to school, and therefore you learn what to do in life from your parents and your family. So if you grow up as a carpenter's son, it never occurs to you to do anything else but carpentry. Why would you? You might become a better carpenter than your father, but still that would be the natural thing to do. It's only when one is exposed to school and then people begin to talk about, well, what do you want to be in life, that people get the idea that they might be anything. So if this sort of way of life is natural to you, you don't find it particularly objectionable. Of course, all kinds of weird complications and rituals and prohibitions grow up in the course of time that can make this system very cumbersome, as it has been until quite recently in India. Then what happens is this. You go through an evolution in your development in this community, which has first of all the stage called brahmacharya, studentship or apprenticeship. After that you enter the stage of grihastha, meaning householder. And a householder has two duties. One is called artha, A-R-T-H-A, and the other kama, K-A-M-A. Artha means the duties of citizenship, partaking in the political life of the community. Kama, K-A-M-A, means the cultivation of the senses, of aesthetic and sensual beauty. And therefore, kama includes the art of love, the arts of beautification, of dress, of cooking, and all that kind of thing. So that the Kama Sutra is the scripture about love. Kama, in a sense, means passion, and is the great Hindu manual of how to behave sexually. It's a book that every child ought to read on gaining puberty, so that he would get some sense of how to make love without being a mere baboon. Then there is also the Artha Shastra, and that is the scripture about rulers and the way of the Kshatriya caste. Now, so you've got these stages now. Brahmacharya, which is studentship, Artha and Kama, they go together, and they constitute the duties of Grihastha, of a householder. Beyond that, there is the duty of Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, and Dharma has many, many meanings in Sanskrit. It can mean something like law or justice. Could even mean slightly righteousness, but not as we have come to understand that word in common speech today. Perhaps rightness would be better than righteousness. But dharma has a primary meaning of method. So when we speak of the dharma of the Buddha's doctrine, it is the Buddha's method, not law. So a citizen also has to conform to dharma. And that is to say, to ritual and ethical and moral game rules for the community. But now, when in the course of time he has established his household, he has taught his oldest son to take over the governorship of the household, the father, or for that matter, mother, may enter into a new stage of life altogether, which is not grihastha, but is called vanaprastha, and that means forest dweller, as distinct from householder. Now you see what's happened. We've gone full cycle. We came out of the forest as a hunter. We settled in a community and indulged in what is called in Sanskrit loka sangraha. Sangraha means upholding. Loka, the world. Upholding the world game. And that is everybody's dharma or duty. Dharma can also be translated duty. And svadharma, S-V-A in front of dharma, means your own duty. Or better, your own function, which we would translate into English as vocation. So everybody's caste work is his svadharma. And of course, these castes are subdivided into various other kinds of specializations. When you have fulfilled your svadharma, you go into the vanaprastha stage. Now, anciently that meant that you actually did go out into the forest, and you became, of all things, it's called a shramana in Sanskrit. S-R-A-M-A-N-A. And it is thought that that is the word shaman. You see, what happens is this then, that an individual who all his life long has played the social game is then says, well, now I've done that. I've assumed this role, I've become identified with tinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, whatever it was. But now who am I? Really? In order to find that out, I have to go off by myself. Why? Because you have a role conception, a mask conception of yourself, because other people tell you who you are. We are constantly, in every social interchange, in the most common remarks, telling other people who they are. Everything leads up to that. The way I act towards you, the way you act towards me, tells me who I am and tells you who you are. For example, you come and sit here and listen to me talk. You are, by doing that, telling me I'm some kind of a teacher. And you're telling yourselves that you're some kind of students. And that's only one thing, you see, one little incident. In business, every day, in your housework and everything you do, everybody around you is telling you what you are and who you are by expecting certain behavior from you, which if you're a reasonable and socially inclined person, you perform because that's what's expected of you. So you are told who you are. So when we come, we'd had enough of that, you see. But he says, no, let's not listen to all this anymore. That's why the shramana, or the vanaprastha, one of the first things he practices is silence. It's called mauna, M-A-U-N-A. And he may take a vow not to speak for a month or a year. And after about a month of mauna, you don't only stop talking, but you stop thinking in words. And that's a very curious experience when it happens, because all the senses take on a tremendous intensity. You see things which you've never seen before, because you stop codifying and classifying the world by thinking. Sunsets appear incredibly more vivid, and flowers are enchanting. The whole world comes alive to the Mauni. The only danger is this. The Mauni has to be careful because he loses all moral discrimination. In other words, if the Mauni gets involved in a riot, he joins the riot. Because that's just the way things are going, you see. And so he has to be careful. And that's why in this state of Vanaprastha, the new man in the game will seek out a guru, a teacher who has been through the whole discipline of yoga or whatever it is that is practiced by a vanaprastha, and will help him out and see that he doesn't get into trouble. That's why a guru, when he accepts a student, is always said to become responsible for that individual's karma. Karma, you know, means activity, and also the results of activity. So you see what's happened. This man who goes into the vanaprastha stage of life takes off every sign that would identify him as someone. He does away with his name. He does away with the usual clothes he would wear and puts on usually a yellow or some kind of a robe, or he may more often than that be really naked and may have a loincloth or not even that. And often these people cover themselves with ashes and their hair is matted and they don't take care of themselves that way anymore because they're outside the pale. You see, they are outcasts, but they are upper outcasts. Below them are the lower outcasts known as today the Harijan, the name that Gandhi gave them, the untouchables. And the untouchables were the aboriginal peoples of India. When the Aryan invasion occurred, at a rather vague date, but shortly after 2000 BC, the Aryans formed these castes, and the people who were originally in the land, like the Indians here, were considered to be outcasts. They were beyond the pale. So, you have here a marvelous microcosm. You have a political and social analog of the manifestation and withdrawal of the worlds, of the Lord playing the game, or the self playing the game of being all of us, and then as each individual reaches moksha, the self realizes in terms of an individual life that it is the self. So exactly in this way, the child representing the self on the way in comes into this world, plays around for a while. There are four castes, just as there are four yugas to the kalpa cycle, you remember? And then out it goes, back to the forest. We would say back to nature. But you see, the outgoing stage of vanaprastha is a much higher state in the course of evolution than the hunting society person who is primitive. He isn't simply going back to where he came from. He's spiraled. He's come round to an equivalent position, but at a higher level. And what he has gained in the interim is self-awareness. I mean that too in the ordinary sense when we speak of self-consciousness. See, it's not much fun to be happy and not know it. We need a certain resonance. Self-consciousness is an echo in our heads, an echo of what we do, but wouldn't be aware of doing it if there wasn't an echo. When you see yourself in a mirror, that mirror is a visual echo of your face. And that's why in a room such as this, it's a very comfortable room for me to talk in, because it has resonance. And so self-consciousness is neurological resonance. Now you know how troublesome resonance can get if it's not properly worked out. You can get echoes that just won't stop. So you go into a great cave somewhere and you say, "Hi!" It says, "Hi, hi, 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 hi," all off in the distance, see? That's very confusing. Now that's the sort of snarl that self-consciousness can get into, and we call it anxiety. When I keep thinking, did I do the right thing in the course of some performance, if I'm constantly aware of myself in a kind of anxious, critical way, my resonance becomes too high. And so I get confused and jittery. But if you learn that self-consciousness has limits.